Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to say that we're joined by the great Sanjeev Bhaskar. Sanjeev, welcome to Kermode on Film. This is your first time on the podcast, I think.
It's my first time on the podcast, and I'm really quite nervous about it.
Oh, don't worry. It's going to be very easy. I'm just going to say lots of nice things, and we're going to have a good time. So basically, I asked you to come on because we've just recently done a Secrets of Cinema on British comedy, which is now on BBC iPlayer. If you haven't seen the programme already, go to BBC iPlayer. It'll be there for a while. Hopefully, we're going to get them to leave it up there for a long while. But who knows? Don't waste time. Go see it now. And when we were making the programme, you featured in it several times, and you had been really helpful throughout making of Secrets of Cinema. Just yesterday, you were doing a lecture at Exeter University, and I was remembering that when we were doing the rom-coms program, when I was looking for clips from Bollywood movies, it was you that I got in touch with and went, Saj, give me three really great clips. And you got me the guys on the train. You remember the thing with the train sequence, which was just
amazing.
Yeah. Really incredible. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the programme about British comedy, but also more generally about comedy. And I want to start with this. One of the things that we didn't in the end use in the programme, although weirdly enough it was a kind of a guiding principle, was a little clip from the film Funny Bones, mm-hmm. which is a film that's kind of, you know, fallen by the way now, but is actually a really odd and interesting little film, in which Jerry Lewis, in England, but in some miserable seaside thing, says this thing about there are comedians who have funny bones. And we quoted that and said there are some people who have funny bones. And in fact, we used a clip of you as an illustration of somebody who is naturally funny. And then there are other people who kind of work at comedy. I know that you work at everything you do, but do you think that there is such a thing as a funny bone?
Yes, I think that is. I mean, it's horses for courses a little bit, because, you know, there were so many people, particularly on British television, who had funny bones. I'm thinking about people like Eric Morecambe or Tommy Cooper, who just couldn't translate to the big screen. I mean, Morecambe and Wise did two or three films, I think.
Yeah, The Intelligence Men.
Intelligence Men, that Riviera touch was another one that they did. But it didn't quite translate to the big screen. And I think the notion of funny bones is really about an intrinsic and inherent understanding of comic timing. And I think that is, I mean, people have funny faces and people kind of do pratfalls and all that kind of stuff. But those are techniques. But that whole sense of timing, which is obviously essential to all comedy and pretty useful in drama as well. I think it comes down to that. I think there are people who just inherently know and can feel it. And I think the ones that translated well to the big screen were the ones who knew how to do it for the big screen. Yeah, I mean, you featured Tony Hancock in a couple of clips. Yeah. And, you know, his films were never as big as he was on television or on the radio.
No.
And, you know, there was something about that, whereas someone like Peter Sellers just kind of got it. He just knew how to pitch his comic performance, whether it was kind of, you know, fairly low key. I mean, the Dr. Strangelove, again, which you featured, does it brilliantly, actually, because the scale of each of the three characters he plays are quite different. And, you know, the President of the United States is probably the most naturalistic of the three, but he he just knew exactly where to pitch that. And, you know, with the Dr. Strangelove character himself, that's quite a big character.
But
you know, like a cameo, only appears, you know, towards the end of the film for a short while. But again, he just knew instinctively where to pitch that.
Tommy, I think there are two types of comedians. There's a funny bones comedian and a non-funny bones comedian. They're both funny. One is funny. The other tells funny. And Tommy, it's time you knew. And this kills me the most. But you're neither. You're not funny. Know it now. They're not going to stand and cheer for you no matter what you do.
Sanjay, I want to ask you to tell a story that you told yesterday. You were doing a lecture at Exeter, and you told a story about something that happened very early on. It was a shocking story, but also it had a great sting in the tail, about when you were younger and you were told that you wouldn't understand something because of who you were. Set this up for us, because I thought it was a really great story.
Well, it was. So I was kind of, you know, I was interested in films from when I was a little kid, and and was quite passionate about film and about filmmaking, actually, not just watching movies and enjoying movies, but how they came about. And to me, it was all magical. And so I was interested in all things that kind of, you know, grew from that and out of that or into it. And we had, I was at school in West London, and we had quite a large Asian, British Asian minority in the school. About a third of the school were Asian. And we had, because there were such large numbers, it was a huge school, it was about 1,600 kids, I think. And they brought in a community liaison sort of teacher to come in there to kind of, you know, bridge that understanding between, you know, the kind of indigenous teachers, particularly, and these kind of, you know, brown-skinned little foreigners. And and I remember walking past this teacher, this particular teacher, who was talking to a maths teacher at the time, and I heard the words theatre, and I kind of marginally stopped and turned my head, which, you know, she caught her eye, and she said, yes. And I said, I'm sorry, I just heard you use the word theatre, and I'm interested in, you know, all that kind of storytelling of every kind. And so I was just curious. That was it. I was about 12 or 13 at that point. And she looked at me and she said, we were talking about music hall. It's not your culture. You wouldn't understand. And I was just really hurt by this, you know. Oh, it was more that my passion for it wasn't engaged with or maybe recognized or something. And I stood my ground and I said, well, what era of music hall are you talking about? Are you talking about the Fred Carno Players? Are you talking about Lupino Lane? Are you talking about Max Miller, Tommy Trinder? I mean, at what point? What are you talking about? And she just stared at me and I said, oh, you probably don't know. And then walked off. But I was really upset by it. I was just annoyed at the preconception, actually. It was the kind of presumption that, you know, how or why would I know about any of these things? But I did by the age of 13.
I went home the other night. There's a funny thing. And I went in the back way, through the kitchen, through the dining room, the drawing room. And there's a fella standing there, not a stitch on. Can you imagine that, lady? Here's your memory, girl. He hasn't got a stitch on. I called the wife in. I said, who's this? She said, don't lose your temper, Miller. Don't go raving mad. I said, I'm only asking a fair question. Who is it? She said, he's a nudist, and he's coming to use a phone. There's a clever one from the wife, eh?
Were you always attracted to comedy? Did you always like things that made you laugh? And when did you first realise that you could make other people laugh?
Again, I think it was quite early on, and I think that it was certainly a defence mechanism. It probably still is. And one of the things that I kind of understood quite early on was there was a place beyond tragic, and that was ridiculous. So, you know, to be able to spin a situation beyond, you know, the challenge into what it was beyond, I think I I was able to do quite quickly. And I think one of the things that fed into that was from a really early age. So my earliest memory is at 2.5. And it's a pratfall, actually. So my earliest memory is 2.5 years old. My parents were buying this flat above a laundrette and they were being shown around it. And I looked up these stairs and, you know, step by step, you know, climbed up it like I was scaling it. And I was probably about 7 or 8 steps up and I slipped and I tumbled down. And the flat was empty. And so the floorboards and so it made a huge racket. And, you know, my parents came rushing out and so my mum said, "What happened?" And I said, I fell from the step. And she said, "Well, which step did you fall from?" And I clambered up to the 7th or 8th step. I said, "This one." And she said, "Well, how did you fall?" So I did it again. So that is my earliest memory. That's 2.5.
But that's like Buster Keaton, isn't it? Buster Keaton became Buster Keaton because at a very young age, his parents had an act in which they would throw him around on the stage and even into the audience. That's how he became Buster, because they said, "Well, it was a real Buster. He was really good at falling over."
Okay, and, so you presumably not getting hurt. that's the other part of the equation.
He was too young to ask. I mean, that documentary recently about Buster Keaton, in which you hear exactly how Buster Keaton was used on stage. Nowadays, the social services would be round. Back then, it was the beginning of a very, very serious career. Okay, so that's a very you said a defense against what? Were you bullied as a kid? Were you unpopular?
Well, no, I had a horrendous time at school, actually. School was
because
I mean, you know, when you grow up, you look back on it, and a lot of it was just peer pressure, but a lot of it was around the fact that, you know, I patently spoke better English than any of my peers. I had a better knowledge of kind of pop culture, a better knowledge of British history than any of my peers. And yet there were constantly kind of assumptions made about me, and which, you know, extended into adulthood as well. But
made, sorry, Sanj, made because?
Well, because I was an Asian kid. It's simple as that. It kind of didn't matter that my kind of diction was good or my kind of vocabulary was broad. Those assumptions were still made. And I remember this was infant school, so I would have been maybe 6 years old. And the production they put on was Aladdin, and I understudied Aladdin, and Aladdin only got the part because he had a judo suit, and so it looked vaguely kind of, you know, sort of Middle Eastern. So that's why he was cast. A boy called Andrew, and yet
I love the fact that you remember his name.
Oh, I'm keeping the surname off just in case, but during the rehearsals of it, the teachers would constantly say, when Andrew was on stage, "Andrew, hold on a second. Sanjeev, could you come up here and show Andrew how to do that scene?" And so I would do the scene and yet was not cast. And, I've said this before, but, you know, one of the most frustrating things was, you know, the nativity every year, where I was always cast as one of the 3 bloody wise men. Every single year, there was me, you know, Hakim and Musapa, and, you know, we were. And 1 year, and I complained, you know, after about the second or third year, I kind of said, "Come on, but, you know, I'm shoo-in for Joseph or maybe the innkeeper or someone." And they said, "You can be a head sheep." And it took me 15 years before I realized the slight. I had a bit of cardboard that was with cotton wool stuck to it that was tied around me, and I had to wander around on all fours, head sheep. So, you know, those kind of assumptions kind of, you know, particularly when I was so passionate about storytelling as well, it cut in a different way. But school, I mean, the period of time, I mean, we're born the same year. So, you know, that period of time towards the end of the 70s, was, you know, racism on the street was quite overt. And so there was that. But also, and something I look back on now as incredibly forming and something I'm hugely grateful for, was that I actually then was also excluded by the Asian kids as well. There was a kid, I remember coming to school, this was when I was about 15, I think. And this Asian kid, one of the prominent British Asian kids, big personalities, came up to me and he said, listen, he said, you can't talk to white people anymore. And I said, I don't know if you've kind of just forgotten where we live and in which country we live, but that's kind of complicated. And he said, well, no, you can't talk to any of the other white kids, teachers you can talk to. And I said, well, why? Because they haven't done anything to me. And he used, you know, then famously used by George W., I suppose, you're either with us or you're against us. And I said, I'm not with you or against you. I'm not, you know, it's kind of just nothing to me. But they then, because he was quite prominent and influential, he was an influencer for his time. Basically, the Asian kids stopped talking to me as well. So there was a period of time of about 3-4 months, over a few years, actually, but it intensified before it got better. And so all of those things kind of, I think, kind of, you know, shaped films, particularly films and television, were my escape. And the fact that I knew more about, I couldn't talk to anyone about, you know, the films I loved, but the fact that I could escape into those just made those emotionally really important to me. And particularly within that comedy, which was just the greatest escape.
See, it's funny, although we have very different, you know, life stories, the one thing that we do have in common, I got very badly bullied at school for a number of reasons. Firstly, I think I was a really difficult kid, but I was really weedy. I was really awkward. I had a stupid name because back then my name was Fairy. I was Mark Fairy. Fairy was my father's name. Kermode was my mother's name. When my mother and father separated, I took my mother's name. If you're a weedy, difficult, awkward kid called Fairy, it's like a boy named Sue. You toughen up really fast because you just get used to being literally the butt of absolutely everything. And I look back on it now and I think, well, it's okay. It made me, I mean, there was a point in my life when I suddenly went from being a very small guy to weirdly being a guy who was twice my size. I suddenly went into my legendary Elvis Fat period and I've never looked back. I mean, I remember the first time I ever went into a diner and I sat down with my wife, Lynn. We sat down at breakfast and the waitress asked her what she wanted. And then she turned to me and said, and how about you, big fella? And I thought, that's it. I have officially put my childhood behind me. I'm going to have two breakfasts. Thank you very much. And I also incidentally remember the names and the surnames of every child in that school. But like you, I found refuge in films, television, not so much, but films all the time. And I loved comedy films.
Why was it not television, by the way? Because that's in your home.
It's a weird thing. I think part of it was that back then, in order to go to, there were about 6 cinemas that I go to. There was the Classic, the Ionic, the Rex, as it was then, 2 Odeons, an ABC. And so, you know, I could go out to any number of cinemas on a bike ride or a bus ride or a walk or whatever it was. And if it was a weekend, I would go on Saturday and Sunday. So you'd spend 2 hours getting there. Then often you'd spend 4 or 5 hours in the cinema because they'd often play double features or at least supporting features. And then it would take you a little while to get back. That would be Saturday. And then Sunday, I'd do the same thing again. And then during the week, we weren't really allowed to watch telly. I mean, the telly went on at 5:45 for Magic Roundabout and the news. And then it was kind of off. So it wasn't really on in our house very much, which I suppose looking back now is odd, but we just, the telly was in a weird room. It wasn't in the sitting room. It was in whatever the off room was now thinking back on it. So it wasn't particularly telly for me. It was always cinema. But I loved going to the cinema and watching comedy. I loved going to see Woody Allen films. I loved going to see Mel Brooks films. I loved anything that was comedy. I learned to, you know, to play the fool, because it kind of, if people laughed at you, they didn't hit you.
That, I mean, that's a really good point. You know, the whole thing about using, you know, the ability to be a jester to avoid being hit. I is certainly something that I kind of used, because I, you know, unlike you, I remained small. And so if someone says big guy to me, there's just no escape. There's no escape at all. But I remember kind of very often being able to sort of get out of potentially quite, so despite all the racism that was around at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and the fact that no one was speaking to me at school, and so you're a bit of a target for those reasons, I very, very rarely got into punch-ups. And I kind of fooled myself into thinking that either they just weren't sure whether I would be lethal. You know, they could, you know, be that kind of, you know, Bruce Lee kind of entered the firmament in sort of like the early 70s. And so therefore, if I carried myself in a particular way, maybe they're just not sure and they'll hold off. As an adult looking back, I think that's less likely. But I think it was the fact that I could come up with something that would make them laugh or amuse them enough for me to be able to get out of that situation. Funny enough, you reminded me the whole thing about going to the cinema. I can't remember whether I've told you this before, but the first argument in a cinema or first incident I had in a cinema with other people was when I was 10. Was that 10? May have been 73. So, and it was going to see with a friend, Nicholas Kennedy, going to see Battle for the Planet of the Apes. And so Nicholas and I are sitting there, and there are four kids behind us. And one of these four is holding court. You know, the other three are in thrall. And he's saying to them, he said, no, right, first it's Planet of the Apes, right? Then they escape from the Planet of the Apes, right? Then there's a conquest, and now it's the battle. And these other kids are going, God, you know everything about films. And I couldn't help it. And I had to turn around and I said, sorry, you're wrong. I said, Beneath the Planet of the Apes was the second film. And it's at the end of that that they lead to the escape and then conquest and then battle. And there was silence for about 2 seconds before this kid just went, fuck off. And I meekly turned around and Nicholas just looked at me and he just said, you idiot. You idiot. I couldn't help it.
We want guns.
Now, the final chapter in the incredible ape saga.
There it is, or was.
This is the hell my forefathers used to speak about.
This background radiation alone will give us 300 rentgens an hour.
The battlefield, a dead city 12 years after the ultimate bomb has been dropped. The prize, the right to inherit what's left of the Earth. The contestants, ape against man. The most unbelievable showdown ever filmed. As the mutants, strange, transformed men who live underground like moles, battle the apes to decide who will be master and who will be slain.
No, you see, but the thing is, I would have done the same if somebody had said that it went Battle for the Planet of the... It went Planet of the Apes, Escape for the Planet of the Apes. It would have taken every bit of strength to not go, no, Beneath the Planet of the Apes. Well, also, because Beneath the Planet of the Apes is, I think, arguably almost the best movie, despite the fact
that... Yeah, I agree.
You know, I mean, the Father, Son and Holy Bomb, the taking off their skin, the worshipping the cobalt. I mean, it's insane. It's a film which literally ends with the whole world being blown up and the screen going white. And I think over here it was a double A certificate, and it was a tough. I mean, that and Conquest of the Planet of the Apes were definitely the toughest of those ones. My friend Tim Polcat and I used to, the first time Planet of the Apes came out on video, we stayed up all night to watch all of them. We were grown up by this point, but we couldn't believe that it was possible to own all the Planet of the Apes movies and watch them all together. And we would constantly have discussions about which bits of the timeline didn't quite work, because there's a weird thing with Battle for the Planet of the Apes, is that Battle for the Planet of the Apes is still before Planet of the Apes by quite a long way. And of course, Battle ends with that whole speech about, we don't know how this is going to work out. Maybe there won't be a future in which the whole world gets, you know, destroyed. And I mean, I would have turned around and told the guy the same thing, and I would have got lamped for it.
It wasn't so much the fact that he got it wrong. It was the fact that he was being lauded for it. That's the thing that really annoyed me. Because if he'd gone, well, this, you know, it's Planet and then Escape, and they've got, and the others have gone, all right. It was just that they started going, God, you know everything about film. And that was the point. You know everything about film? I'm sorry, sir. I beg to differ. And I was lucky I didn't get slap in the face for that.
No, but I mean, that would have absolutely driven me nuts. Okay, so when you were about that age, who were the people who were making you laugh?
Well, because most of my film watching came from television. And so I think really early on, during the summer holidays, Easter holidays, all that sort of stuff, BBC Two in particular would just run old films, and starting from about 9:10 in the morning. So there'd be a Chaplin, and then be Buster Keaton or Harold Lloyd or Laurel and Hardy or something like that. And then there'd be, you know, there'd be a film in the middle, which would be a Cleopatra or something. And then there'd be something like Genevieve or, you know, so I got my broad kind of introduction and kind of love for, certainly for old films from that. And then the films that generally my parents took me to. So I think the first film I remember going to see was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I think either that or Mary Poppins. It was one of the two. My mum took me to one, my dad took me to the other. But, you know, at that age, the nearest cinema to us was at least a bus ride away. Also, my parents were taking me to Bollywood films on the weekend. So, you know, they couldn't be asked. I mean, let's face it, they carry the blame for this, to take me to see other films. But it was very much that, and very aware of Peter Sellers and the Goons. I kind of started to listen to quite early on the radio. They'd repeat a lot of the Goon stuff.
I had a couple of Goon Show LPs. I had The Histories of Pliny the Elder and The Dreaded Batter Pudding Hurler of Bexhill-on-Sea, which I think my dad bought for me. And then I had a book of Goon Show scripts, and I would get my sister and my brother to record them. My dad had an old, you know, reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I'd get my brother and sister to, you know, we'd recreate the Goons. I mean, rather badly, but it was the fact that we had a recording equipment and the script, and I used to love all of that stuff. And then, of course, when Hitchhiker's Guide started on the radio, that for me was like, okay, this is like punk rock Goons. I mean, I loved radio comedy. Radio comedy absolutely worked for me.
Yeah, well, also because I had a little transistor radio with a little earpiece thing, so when I was meant to go to bed, you know, that's the point where I'd kind of throw the covers over and put that on. So Hitchhikers for me was hugely influential, but they would play there was a lot of comedy on radio at that point as well.
When we did the program, one of the clips that we used of you was a clip from Yesterday, which is Danny Boyle's film of Richard Curtis's script. And one of the reasons that we used it was because it was to do with timing, because there aren't obvious gags in that scene. The gag is the kid is trying to play the song and he keeps getting interrupted. And the thing that makes the gag funny is the timing of the interruption, specifically Terry next door, whoever it is, comes in and everyone sits in there and you keep offering like a beer or a cup of tea or whatever. When you break that scene down, there aren't jokes in it. I mean, you know, there are jokes, but they're very, very kind of, if you look at that scene on the page, how do you envisage it in your head as, because it is everything to do with that scene is to do with how those gaps are played out.
That's the thing about the inherent timing thing. And obviously a scene like that can be fixed and tightened in an edit. But you know, when you're on set, you play it as if you're in the theatre. You know, you try to get that timing right, because also everybody else feeds off the timing. So, you know, it becomes rhythmic. And so it's very musical, I think, comedy when it's played in that way. You know, people talk about rules of three and things like that, but comedy is very much about rhythms. And it's that strange thing where, you know, the funniest thing in a scene is the length of a pause. And if that pause is a half a second too short, it's not funny. Half a second too long, it's not funny. There's a kind of comedy sweet spot that you have to hit. And that's impossible to teach. It's absolutely impossible to teach. And that's something you just have to feel.
Okay, so this is like the principle of having funny bones. You've either got that or you haven't, and you can't learn it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, over time, you know, we've seen lots of, you know, people regarded as comedy actors who've been really good at drama and not necessarily the other way around. And I think it's because of that. I remember, so I do a series called Unforgotten, which is a sort of detective drama series. And I remember after the first series, the questions I got asked most often was, what about this switch from comedy to drama? And I started off saying, I don't approach the two any differently, to be quite honest, because you have a character and either silly, funny things happen to that character or serious stuff happens. But actually, the more I started talking about it, the more I realized just quite how technical comedy is. And actually with drama, also because comedy requires a really specific response from the audience, which is laughter. You know, drama does not require people to wail, you know, for that clarity to kind of go, have I been understood? But comedy does. And I think that notion of that sweet spot in terms of timing, I think is really difficult, if not impossible, to teach.
Why don't you play one for us?
Okay. You sure?
Yeah, of course. Me and your dad love hearing your things, don't we, darling?
We do.
Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. Okay. Right, this is called Let It Be.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking...
Oh, sorry, love, I'll get it. Mm.
Good start, love. Very pretty.
Oh, Terry, hello, come in, love. Oh, it's Terry.
Oh, hello. Terry.
Hey, Terry. Jack's just playing us a new song.
Oh, really? I thought he'd given up.
Yeah, no, well, he's got some new songs. What's this one called?
Leave It Be.
Let It Be. Oh, excellent. Well, rock on, Jack.
I used to do, you know, back in the 80s, I used to do a stand-up musical comedy act, as many people who then didn't go on to be comedians did. And I've experienced both it going down really well, which was the best thing, and I've experienced being canned off stage in Hull and hearing that thing about the jokes nobody finding them funny. And then you are literally left alone on stage, surrounded by just increasing anger. And it is a really terrifying thing. Like you said, a play can go badly and people can just be bored. But if a comedian is on stage and people aren't laughing, it's, you know, it is disastrous. But when you say that thing about music, about it's musical, I think that music of comic timing is connected to the fact of music hall and musical comedy, and those things they are from the music. I mean, it's funny that even now the Golden Globe still has a category which is musical or comedy. Mm-hmm. Why? That makes absolutely no sense, except that historically music and comedy were always tied together. It's only sort of later on that they've been separated, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the interesting thing about, you know, thinking about how comedy developed in Britain as opposed to America was that, you know, I've always felt that, you know, British fictional writing for the screen, certainly, the British have always been, you know, and the Europeans have been better at character. It's been character driven, whereas American films have been plot driven. And, you know, with a very broad brush. And I think it's because, you know, Britain had a literary heritage. So someone like Shakespeare, you know, in terms of Shakespeare's comedy, so, you know, Shakespeare did kind of satire and he did slapstick. He had clowns in almost all of his plays, but also the absurd. I mean, you know, the actor, you know, exit pursued by a bear is apropos of nothing. I mean, it's absolutely surreal. So he had a handle on that. He had farce, you know, there was farce in there as well, you know, mistaken identities, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think screwball comedies, if you look at something like Taming of the Shrew or what's the other one? Oh, the great one that...
Midsummer Night's Dream.
I was thinking of Midsummer Night's Dream. I mean, that's weird as well. Yeah, bloke gets really, turned into donkey.
Really weird.
Whereas, you know, magic dust makes two people fall in love with the wrong people. You know, there's all that sort of weirdness going on. Much Ado About Nothing.
All right.
I was thinking about is a screwball comedy. I mean, that's, you know, that's the kind of, you know, Tracy Hepburn stuff that happened in the 30s in America. So I think all that literary heritage was what Britain had. And then, you know, I think across the Victorian period, theatre became for, you know, became expensive and it's for toffs. And so music hall emerged. And that whole thing of a bit of music, a bit of juggling, a bit of slapstick, et cetera, that's what kind of carried us into the 20th century when film started. And so I think the roots of that, I think, are very different. Whereas in America, I think that the whole vaudeville thing, which was very similar to music hall, the fact that film was an American medium, in effect, they didn't have that literary heritage. It was also a land of immigrants. So having these silent films and particularly comedies that could then appeal to all these people across different generations and different coming from different countries was made commercial sense, you know, and those are the films that then traveled around the world. And then, as you said, in Secrets of Cinema, kind of established the template really for comedy movies. Britain didn't have that. And also, you know, at that point in sort of, you know, 1914 to kind of, you know, the talkies, sort of mid-20s, mid to late 20s, was that Europe was blighted by a war. And so that development that came through the experience of continually making stuff and refining it happened in America a lot quicker. And then by the time, you know, you'd got to post the First World War, certainly, and those interwar years, you know, Hollywood had the, you know, the monopoly in kind of exporting what film comedy was. And I think Britain was always playing catch up until Britain found its, British comedy found its own voice.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Did you recognize, I mean, we were talking, and one of the things we try and do in that program is to sort of, you know, identify archetypes and structures through genres. And one of the things that we put forward was this idea of the little man being very, very sort of central to the two things that British comedy does is it's very good about the, you know, the little man, kind of epitomized by Chaplin, although Chaplin's, you know, film career was entirely American, well, largely American for the beginning. But it was still a figure which goes, you know, from him into George Formby and into Norman Wisdom and, you know, And then the fact that we are also very good at skewering our own pomposity in a way that nobody else, I think, is. Did that strike a chord with you? Did you think, yes, that makes sense, or you think that's a contrivance?
No, that made absolute sense. And I think that, you know, going beyond, again, comedy, if one looks at the oldest texts, you know, things like, I mean, the Odyssey is really about a little man. And, you know, there are gods who are kind of like, you know, pushing him this way or that way, but it's essentially just an ordinary bloke. And so I think that notion of the small man, I think, has always been there. It's, you know, it's the individual who is too small to comprehend this universe. And, you know, the fact that, you know, things happen to you and around you and that you have no control over, and trying to make sense of that. So I think the character of the small man, I think, has always been there. I think that the notion of it then becoming, you know, a comic creation, I think happened later. I think that happened over time when people began to know that you can say things through that particular character that you couldn't in any other way. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, again, interesting to me. I mean, one of my favorite films of all time, as you know, is A Matter of Life and Death. I mean, there is no greater thing that the small man in that is trying to battle, you know, there is nothing bigger. But I think, yeah, I mean, Chaplin absolutely kind of understood that. And I think culled from his own experiences, I think the other difference was that the American idea of the small man was aspirational in a way that the British small man wasn't. You know, the British small man were, you know, they were quite contained stories. You know, the Ealing comedies are quite contained stories, whereas I think the American ones, I think, as they always have done, you know, pushed for that achievement,
yeah,
at the end. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, so with Chaplin, he would never win, but there would be the little shrug and the kick, and he'd be off to aspire again.
He'd be undefeated. He wouldn't move, yeah, on, but he would still persist. And I think that's the thing. It's kind of, and actually, I think that's true of the Norman Wisdom and George Formby films, mm-hmm, as well, which is that the winning was that they were still there.
Yeah.
They was, you know, they had survived, and like you said, the Chaplin kick and a shrug, and then off we go. And it's the not being obliterated. I mean, there is something quite existential about it. It is a kind of, by the end of the film, he's still there, you know, and particularly in the case of Chaplin, no matter what else has happened, he's still there.
But also, you know, with Norman Wisdom, and I don't know the George Formby films quite as well, but with Norman Wisdom, you know, if he was raising money for the little kid to buy him a present or whatever, or for an orphanage or whatever, he would have raised it,
yeah,
by the end of the film. It's not that he didn't raise it, whereas Chaplin just never got there. He never got the money. Yeah. He never got the thing. You know, it was, and yet he was this guy who was undaunted by that. And I think that was part of the American dream, wasn't it? You know, and that whole notion of kind of like, no, try again. You two can become president.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you were talking about, you know, going back to Odyssey and classic texts. I wonder where, therefore, the figure of King Arthur sits for you in your kind of career development.
Well, on stage, obviously.
But tell me about that, because tell me about that, Sanj, because that is such a big deal. You kind of shrug it off now, but you know.
Do you know what? It's one of the big sort of life turning points for me. Actually.
Okay, so tell us, how did it happen? How did it come about?
So I came back from filming a sitcom series in India, and it was a really difficult experience. It was really, really tough and not particularly pleasant. And the series that was made wasn't fantastically good either. There's, you know, 7 episodes, of which I think 3 are quite good. And I came back really kind of jarred by the experience. And I came back, and there was, you know, one of the big West End producers I bumped into at the Evening Standard Awards or something like that. And this producer approached me and said, look, we're doing this play. And I spoke to the writer, think you'd be great for it. And I thought, well, that's fantastic. That is, oh, thank goodness. You know, that'd be great. A West End play, that'd be brilliant. Told my agent, he's very happy. The writer is on board and the producer's on board. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, I called my agent to say, well, what, you know, what's happening with that? He said, look, I don't know how to tell you this, but the offer's been withdrawn. And I said, why? And it was one of the other actors in that play who I didn't have scenes with objected to me being in it. And
because?
Said, well, the argument that was given to me was, well, he's telly. And so, you know, I want to work with people who've got, you know, it wasn't even a greater profile. I think it was just somebody with more respect. This particular actor was very upwardly sort of aspirant. And I, yeah, a bit. You know, I'll tell you who it was afterwards. And I was absolutely kind of like, you know, floored by this. And I then got a call saying, look, you know, the Spamalot have been in touch. And would you like to go in and audition? for King Arthur. And I said, well, I've never auditioned for a musical. And I thought, well, that's new. I'll go and find out what a musical audition is like. I've no idea. And I think about 3 days after I did it, they said, you've got the job. And apart from the fact that it was, you know, it was Python. And so, you know, all the references from the Holy Grail and Life of Brian and everything else they threw in there that, you know, I used to do in the playground and do with my mates. Suddenly I was doing on stage. That was extraordinary. I was given a leeway by Eric Idle, who wrote it, after he saw it, to absolutely improvise whatever I wanted. He said, all that you're doing, all the improvising you're doing is the spirit of Python. So carry on. I've told everyone, I've told the production, blah, blah, blah. Let him kind of just run with it. And so I was given extraordinary freedom. And then within that, you know, I'd bumped into, completely by chance, 3 days before I was on stage opening, at a mutual friend's house, I bumped into Terry Jones and ended up sitting opposite him. And I said, Terry, can I ask you a geeky question about the Holy Grail? And he said, yeah. And I said, how long did it take you to shoot the Camelot dance sequence? Because there's lots of edits in it and there's tons of things going on. And he said, it was a day. And I said, well, you did the whole thing in a day. There's, you know, there's the playing on the helmets, the knight's helmets. There's a bit of the curtain comes down. There's treading on a cat. I mean, there's tons going on. And he said, yeah, we shot it in a day. And I kind of then said to him, listen, I've got to be honest with you. I'm opening in Spamalot soon. And I've read that you don't like the stage production. And I was wondering why. And he said, oh, you don't need to know that. And I said, no, I'm curious. I've signed a contract, so I'm doing it anyway, but I'm curious. So what I got was a set of fantastic acting notes about what he felt Graham Chapman did successfully in the part and what he felt he hadn't seen on stage. So I used all of that to inform me playing it. And I remember kind of thinking that, you know, that, I remember, again, journalists kind of asking me, either they would say, well, an Asian King Arthur. And I remember saying to them, I said, look, if people are thinking about my ethnicity when they leave the theatre, then I just haven't done my job. And so, the Lady of the Lake, unlike the film, King Arthur then kind of ends up with the Lady of the Lake. And the Lady of the Lake was always cast as really tall. and I kind of did suggest, should I get a little stepladder for the kiss? And that's going to take too long. And it's kind of, and I thought, is that the point where everyone's going to laugh? And initially I was hired for 3 months and they extended it to 6 months. So I could close the show in the West End. And not one audience laughed at the point that the, you know, very, very tall Lady of the Lake has to stoop to kiss me. And it was, I thought, that I've done my job. They've bought into the characters. They're not gone, well, that's a bit, what is this, a perspective thing? Is she kind of like 8 feet in front of him? And so, you know, and through that, I then met, Michael Palin, Terry Gilliam, and, you know, became friends with them. So, you know, as a pivotal moment in terms of profession and life, it was an extraordinary experience, and particularly coming off the back of such disappointment, you know, it's one of those things that I kind of, you know, Mira and I talk about, and I kind of say, you know, if we don't get a job, I always kind of say, you have no idea what's coming up, no idea. And you know, that no idea may be, you know, a week, a month, a year, it might be 2 years, but you still have no idea what's coming up.
Old woman!
Man!
Ma'am, sorry. What knight lives in that castle over there?
I'm 37.
What?
I'm 37. I'm not old.
Well, I can't just call you man.
You could say Dennis.
I didn't know you were called Dennis.
Well, you didn't bother to find out, did you?
I did say sorry about the old woman, but from behind you looked...
What I object to is you automatically treat me like an inferior.
Well, I am king.
Oh, king, eh? Very nice. And how'd you get that, eh? By exploiting the workers. By hanging on to outdated imperialist dogma which perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society. If there's ever going to be any progress...
Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here! Oh! How'd you do? How do you do, good lady? I am Arthur, King of the Britons. Whose castle is that?
King of the who?
The Britons.
Who are the Britons?
Well, we all are. We are all Britons. And I am your king.
Oh, didn't know we had a king.
On the note of that, let me ask you to, again, repeat a story that you told yesterday about a friend of yours saying that they'd had a very bad week because of the jobs that they'd lost.
Yeah, that was an actor friend of mine some years back, and we met for a coffee, and he was looking quite down, and I said, what's the matter? And he said, it's an awful week. I've lost three jobs this week. And I said, gosh, that's terrible. My goodness, how did you lose them? And he said, well, I auditioned, I didn't get them. And I said, oh, so you didn't get them then? And he said, well, yeah, I lost them. And I said, no, well, you didn't lose them. You have to have something to lose it. And he said, well, it's the same thing, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, I haven't got a job. And I said, no, they're completely different, because by you saying losing it, you've just created in your internal monologue a judgment of yourself as loser, failure. And next time you go for a job, you'll be battling that. And so, yeah, it's something you didn't get. And so, you know, disappointment, fine. Learn from it or whatever, but move on from it, you know.
Let me finish by asking you something. When we did the Pop Movies program, we talked, you know, a little bit about the Elvis movies. I do still think that the general rule about Elvis's movies before the army had ambition and Elvis's movies after the army less so. But the one thing that I think, going back and looking at some of the lesser Elvis movies, is that he was funny. I know that we often hear about, you know, with Elvis on stage doing jokes and sometimes rambling, sometimes they hit the mark, sometimes they don't. But there are little moments. I mean, even in things like Roustabout and Kissing Cousins and, you know, films which are not great films, in which his timing looks to me to be like, you've got a comedian's timing.
Yeah, I think that's true. The one sort of plainly comic film that he made, which was post-army, was Follow That Dream, which is a bit of a kind of Beverly Hillbillies thing, you know, the kind of Clampett's type family. And so his comic performance in that is actually pretty good, because I think in a lot of the moments in, you know, as the films got worse, when they gave him the comedy moment, they landed too hard on it. You know, he would have to do, it would be the funny look aside and, you know, with a kind of, you know, a sound
wah,
effect.
Wah.
Yeah. And, but actually quite early on, and Follow That Dream was maybe a couple of years after he came out of the army. So, you know, there were moments in G.I. Blues and Blue Hawaii, which were the biggest commercial successes he had, where he has those comedy moments where he's still playing characters. And not to kind of draw too great a similarity, but Peter Sellers in the first two Pink Panthers, I think, is a fantastic comedy creation. And by the last two, I find it a little bit difficult to watch. I mean, they're great set pieces, but there's no character anymore. It's just a caricature. But those first two, the Pink Panther and Shot in the Dark, which I think is brilliant, are my favourite. There's a real character there that you can believe is kind of bumbling.
Sanj, I know you know this, but so who wrote Shot in the Dark?
Oh, gosh, this is... I do know this. Go on, tell me.
It was written by William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist.
It was Blatty. Of course it was.
It's just the greatest joy ever. Because, of course, he was a comedy writer before he wrote The Exorcist. And as he said, one stroke, a very promising career in comedy, was completely obliterated by writing this.
Only because that's a fantastic bit of trivia. I've got another bit of trivia for you. Because, you know, one of the things that you featured in Secrets of Cinema was that, you know, the 70s British cinema was so dominated by those TV spin-offs.
Yes.
And, you know, incredibly, I think there were maybe two or three that had multiple films. I think Steptoe and Son had two. But On the Buses, I think, had three.
Yeah. They were made by Hammer, weren't they, I think?
They were made, a lot of those were made by Hammer, yeah. But the first person to use an ATM in Britain was Reg Varney.
No.
There you go.
Well, in real life?
In real life.
How?
That, I don't know. Maybe he caught a bus and he kept playing.
It was much more than a spectacle. The world's first cash machine was born right here in Enfield, half a century ago. Judith Simpson, was 20 years old that day. She came to see what all the fuss was about.
Well, I remember there was quite a crowd outside the bank. A lot of people didn't really know what was going on, so I think people came just to be nosy, really. I remember that that Reg Varney was here, and he put, I think, some sort of piece of paper into the machine, and out came money, which was extraordinary in those days. To get money out of a wall was bizarre.
That's just fantastic. I should say, you know, if people are watching this on the Patreon page, they'll know because there's a video. But for anyone who isn't, you're sitting there wearing a very lovely Elvis 68 Comeback Special T-shirt. And I'm sitting here with, behind me, the Elvis bust, which my wife won't allow me to have in the house, and the dancing Elvis doll.
Oh, that's very good.
It's very, very good.
Just looking behind me, I've got an Elvis trivia game, which is down here. That's an Elvis thing. I've got a taking care of business.
Very good.
There, and a load of books there. And, look, I've got How Does It Feel? By Mr. Mark Kermode.
I'm so thrilled that that's on your bookshelf, and I hope you didn't just put it there as a prop.
I didn't. And you are between Roger Moore, his last book, and me and a guy named Elvis by Jerry Schilling.
Wow.
Oh, there you go. You're
wow. You know, there was a period in my life when I did nothing but read Elvis biographies, and you know, many of which are terrible, many of which are great, but many of which are terrible. And quite often the most terrible ones are ones that are written by people who were sort of on the periphery of,
yeah,
you know,
right.
And my favorite one is, you know, I was Elvis's brother, to which the answer is no, you weren't. No, you weren't. I'm sorry, you know. No, you weren't. I love the fact that you love Elvis as much as I do. I mean, you love Elvis more than I do. I think you certainly know more about Elvis than I do, but I think it's been something over which we've bonded over the years. When you first came on MK3D, you came on to talk about Flaming Star and how much that movie meant to you, and I think it's great. I used to have these three rules, you know, this thing, but these three rules of life, which was don't cheat on your wife, don't review any film you haven't seen, and don't be disrespectful about Elvis. That was it. And that actually saw me through many, many years. I've kind of broadened it out now. It was when I liked the idea that all life was, you know, you could get a... Nick has put a picture in the chat of... Here is a picture of Reg at the ATM.
Oh,
wow.
Well, there you go.
Wow.
I didn't realise there was documentary kind of evidence
that
of it.
That is amazing. Well, listen, Sanjeev, it's been fantastic talking to you. What are you up to at the moment? I mean, obviously, you're our kind of go-to sit-in Wittertainment presenter whenever we're off. What are you doing at the moment?
I love doing that. I absolutely
we love you doing it.
Love doing it. The series Unforgotten that I mentioned before, or if you've edited it out, there's a series called Unforgotten.
This is unedited, Sanj. This just goes out as it is. Everything you've
raw.
Said would have been heard in the podcast.
Raw footage. I've done that for three series. And just an interesting point on that, actually, going back to the comedy thing, was that I'd not really done a kind of, you know, a distinctly and clearly drama series before. I'd done little bits in here and there, but not a series. And the writer, Chris Lang, I asked him why he'd cast me. And he said, I thought if you've got good comic timing and you're able to apply that to drama, that's the best of both worlds. And what was interesting was that in the first series, we had people like Bernard Hill and Tom Courtney, people who can do comedy, you know, and find that line between comedy and drama. And since then, I've realized that he keeps that in mind with people that he's cast, is people who can do both. Because if you can apply that sense of innate timing to drama, then, you know, you're probably saving some months of money somewhere. So the fourth series of that, which we filmed last year, mostly pre and some of it post the various lockdowns,
yeah.
That's going to be on telly in the next month or so.
And I assume that you've not been filming during all this period of lockdown, or have you?
Not during this period at all, no. There's been, since it was announced, Neil Gaiman's The Sandman that's being made. And so I have a small part in that.
You're on so the variety poster. It's not that small, Sange.
I only assume that it was by mistake. It was kind of, we've gone on holiday by mistake moment. I think it was all these other people that go, yeah, I know him, and him is in it.
It's King Arthur. Got King Arthur.
Jennifer Saunders told a really lovely story about doing some research, going on a research trip with Ruby Wax and Goldie Hawn to India. And she said, wherever we went to, whichever town, you know, people would just be crazy for the fact that Goldie Hawn had turned up. And she said, we would be, you know, in her wake, trailing in her wake, hearing people shout out, it's Goldie Hawn, Goldie Hawn, and her team. Which is great.
Well, that's a lovely note to end on. Thanks ever so much for giving me stuff. It's been lovely to talk to you, always is. And come back on. I mean, just to talk about nothing at all. I mean, it's kind of, you know, we can shoot the shit about comedy and Elvis and whatever you want to talk about. So,
do you know what I love about the conversations that you have actually on your podcast generally, but actually whenever I've sat down with you, is that they are just organic meandering conversations, and I genuinely have no idea where they're going to go.
No, well, you sent me a text. You said, any tips on what we're going to talk about? Not really. Just you know, anything and everything would be fine. Yeah, it's been lovely, Sanchez. Thanks ever so much. And
Thank you.
I hope to see you soon when all this is behind us, because I have missed the physical interaction. You know, you, me, Dave Norris, pint of lager. It'd be, you know. What could possibly be better than that? In the meantime,
be done.
Give my love to your family and everyone be well. Thanks ever so much for listening to this podcast. If you want to see the pictures of Sanj wearing his lovely Elvis t-shirt and me with my Elvis bust, you can go to the Patreon page where there's a bunch of extras there as well. And remember to subscribe, tell your friends, do all the usual stuff. Keep watching the skies. Stay well. Stay home. Protect the NHS. Thank you very much.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.